Hi, this is Dr. Kimberly Leonard, the author of Visualizing Happiness in Every Area of Your Life and podcast host here at Incredible Life Creator. And today, my guest is Dr. David Alfrey. Dr. David Alfrey began a 36-year career as an anesthesiologist in Nashville, Tennessee, in 1980. He has served as the Chief of Anesthesia, President of Tennessee State Society of Anesthesiologists, and was founding member of Anesthesia Medical Group, one of the largest anesthesia practices in the United States. For 20 years, he served as an oral examiner for the American Board of Anesthesiology, ending his tenure as a senior examiner. He holds an academic appointment at Vanderbilt University Medical Center as an adjunct associate professor of anesthesiology. While in practice, he participated in numerous medical missions with Operation Smile. Dr. Alfrey has authored 10 chapters in medical textbooks and 41 peer-reviewed articles in anesthesiology medical journals. He has invented several anesthesia devices that are sold worldwide and for which he has been awarded 17 U.S. and international patents. He has been married to his medical school sweetheart, Joyce, for over 45 years, and together they have produced 3 daughters and 5 and counting grandchildren. His newest book, Saving Grace, What Patients Teach Their Doctors About Life, Death, and the Balance in Between, was released this year. And I was practicing this before I came on, and I only messed up anesthesiologist once. That is a hard word to say over and over. But I got it over. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Alfrey.
Thank you so much. So happy to be here.
Yeah, and I am so happy and thankful that you're here and that you can share with us your experiences as, you know, being a doctor for that many years, because that's a lot of lives that you touched, a lot of lives that, you know, were different because you were in it. So I'm just so happy that you're here.
Well, thank you. I had a great career and was so fortunate to do what I did all those years. Mm-hmm. I feel so like the luckiest guy in the world.
Yeah. And just so we can get a feel for like where you started out and how you got to be where you were, did you grow up and say, hey, I wanted to be a doctor? Or?
You know, I grew up in a day when doctors still made house calls. And I think our family doctor really had a profound effect on me. So I went off to Tulane University in New Orleans as a pre-med student, but then took a detour down to Bourbon Street. And I became the youngest legal bartender on Bourbon Street at 19 and decided I would have fun rather than go to college. I quit pre-med. I almost flunked out. I got a couple of D minuses. And when I graduated, said, you know, You really do want to be a doctor. You better go do the work. So I took a couple of more years of the pre-med requirements and just barely got into LSU Medical School. Was heading to be a cardiac surgeon at the University of Kentucky and was getting really burned out. And the chief of anesthesia took me aside and gave me a little career advice. And in the space of about a 30-minute conversation, I decided I would take his advice and become an anesthesiologist instead. Mm-hmm. And he called the chairman at University of California, San Diego, which is one of the best programs in the country. And he said, they'll be filled, but I'll give them a call. And turned out that they had somebody drop out at the last minute. So a monumental change in my life at that time, based on a 30-minute conversation. I spent 3 years out in San Diego, subspecializing in cardiac anesthesia, and then went off to Nashville for this wonderful 36-year career.
Beautiful. So you had that one person that really changed your life just with that one conversation.
Yeah, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. There's a number of people in the book that were real mentors of mine. And I, like many people, I didn't really tell them that they were my mentor. And I never thanked them for being my mentor. But since the book has come out, I have contacted him and I've contacted a couple of the doctors in the first few chapters and said, you know, Rick, you never realized this, but you had such a profound effect on my career. and who I became as a doctor. And it was just wonderful reconnecting with them. And, you know, one thing I'd like to emphasize in this podcast is it's never too late to go back to your mentors and thank them for the pivotal role that they played in your life.
I agree, because they mean so much to us, and sometimes they don't know that. I mean, yeah. Even the profession I'm in, I learned from a mentor, and he and his wife had invited me to Thanksgiving. This was after I wasn't working with them anymore. And I said to him, you know, it's because of you that I've been able to help thousands and thousands of people. I said, you helped thousands, but because you showed me what to do, I'm helping even thousands more. And, you know, he cried. He cried.
It's wonderful that you told him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So what are some of the things you learned as you went through life?
Oh, gosh. You know, I can tell you this. Most of the important things I know, I learned from my profession, from being. That's why the subheading of the book, Saving Grace, is what patients teach their doctors about life, death, and the balance in between. You know, we have this shared humanity in the doctor-patient relationship. And it's this wonderful bond that I know, certainly from the physician's side, it's just so important, and that sense of trust that patients give us. And I learned everything from how to be more grateful for the things that I have a better perspective on life, understand the suffering that patients go through, understand what it's like to be a patient myself or somebody that I love, and basically all the things that make us tick, you know, whether it's a characteristic, an emotion, or a principle by which we live. I learned all of those from my patients.
Mm-hmm. So think about when you were first starting out younger and how you thought about things. And then what are some realizations that you made? I know that one time I was at continuing education, and this was several years into my practice, and someone said, you know, we're just practicing medicine.
Yes.
Because people have gotten up and they had given 3 or 4 different treatments for the same thing. And I'm like, oh, because I, being a perfectionist, I thought there was a perfect treatment and I had to find it. But there really isn't, because we're trying to find what's best for that person.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you think about, you know, we've got a joke in all medical schools, there's a little joke that goes around. What do you call the person who finishes last in your medical school class? Doctor.
Uh-huh.
And I know I want my doctor to have gotten 100 on all of the tests, but nobody gets 100 on all of the tests. Mm-hmm. I think one of the really profound things, and it's universal, is we're not going to live forever. And I think when you're in your 20s and your 30s, you get caught up in your career and the life that you're building. And the thought, as I would see patients who would perish, that they would die. And it was as though they were traveling to a distant continent that I was never going to sail there. And then as you get into the older decades, it kind of dawns on you that you're not going to be here forever. You know, I quote a great phrase in the book that we live 2 lives. The second one begins when we realize we have only one. Mm-hmm. I think other changes are when you become a physician, you're pretty pumped up, and you can be a little self-important about it, and you think that you're going to be king of the world. You don't have to be practicing medicine very long to get some humility beaten into you. There's just so many trials and so many failures and so much heartache along the way that I think that over time you learn humility and you learn real gratitude for what you have. That's just a few of the things I've learned. Mm-hmm. There's 15 chapters in the book, and there are 15 sort of little lessons. You know, one's gratitude, one's trust, suffering, and so forth.
Yeah, I love the way you broke that up in the book with those different words, because it just is very, just the first of all, the words you chose are all very meaningful. So they, you look at that word and go, I wonder what he's going to write about that.
You know, when I started this, I looked around, I finished my career and I looked around to see what else had been written about life in the OR from the perspective of an anesthesiologist. And I realized nothing had been written by an anesthesiologist, which was amazing, because the discovery of anesthesia, general anesthesia, in 1847 is considered by many to be the greatest advance in medicine in the history of like ever. And nobody's ever really described what goes on in the OR and the ICU from the perspective of the people at the head of the table, those people that are going to take you closer to death than you'll ever come in your life and bring you back. And so I thought, I've got to tell the story of what goes on in the OR and what really goes on, not what you see, not what you see on TV or in a medical romance novel. So there's a lot of sort of inside information. And I found that as I was writing sort of about myself and about the things that I did, I really ended up writing about patients. So the book is far more about patients than it is me. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to end up with a book that was a tribute to the patients who allowed me to take care of them.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're a person of high integrity. And, you know, how important is it for you to have integrity with yourself and also have integrity with your patients? And how does that show up?
You know, I just can't imagine. Well, first of all, I can't imagine going through life without integrity, you know, and integrity is one of those things like pregnancy. You either have it or you don't. Mm-hmm. You don't kind of have integrity. And I don't see how you could possibly be a physician without having integrity. I mean, the, you know, our codes of ethics are, you know, do no harm, beneficence, do what's best for the patient. You know, we have to be 100% trustworthy. I can't imagine being a physician without having the highest ethics and realizing that, like I told my daughter, who's a child psychiatrist, when she was going through her training, I said, Jana, you're gonna transition from thinking that the patient is there for you to realizing you are there for the patient. Mm-hmm. And that's just part of the integrity, I think, that you have to have, that it's an honor to take care of a patient. So live up to that honor.
Mm-hmm. So if you give us just a sample of if you had a patient and they were very fearful, let's say they're going into a surgery, which a lot of people are fearful, and they're, yes, that one of the main fears I think they would have, and you can tell me if this is right, that they're not going to wake up. And, you know, you have so much power over that. So how would you talk to a patient? What do you say to them to help them traverse that?
Along with that, the other common thing that you have is this loss of control. And you see a lot of patients that are, you know, that maybe they're an executive or they've got a high power job or whatever it might be. They're kind of a control freak. And the idea that they're going to give up control. So those two things are the major concerns that people have. In terms of control, I would tell them, you know, it's not like everything stops and I take over everything. Your heart's still beating. Your blood is still circulating. Your kidneys are still working. I'm just dancing around the edges with your consciousness. You know, you're still doing all the things you're supposed to do. So, you know, you lose a little control in that I'm taking care of you, but not complete. And in terms of waking up, I tell them that anesthesia has advanced so much in the last 30 years. When I went into the profession, we had some of the highest malpractice premiums in America of all the specialties, because if you had a problem, it was a big problem. And the patient ended up either, you know, very, very damaged or dead. And anesthesia has gotten so safe now in America with our monitoring that the malpractice premiums are very low. So I would tell them that anesthesia has never been safer. And the last thing I would say is, you know, we only charge for waking you up. We don't charge for the going to sleep part. And they always seem to have that little lightness. They would, okay.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, I read in your bio that you actually created some tools for that. Were those tools for safety, or what were those tools used for?
Well, it's kind of a crazy story. There's a, when you do thoracic anesthesia, you do something called one lung anesthesia. We put a tube down that you ventilate one lung while the surgeon operates on the other. And sometimes you need a little oxygen into that lung, a CPAP, just so you have a CPAP machine. Uh-huh. And in order to put CPAP in that lung when you needed it, I just invented a little device for that. And I was giving a talk to the company that was making it out in San Francisco and educating the salesmen about physiology and so forth. And the head of R&D, the company was Mallinckrodt, a pretty big name. The head of R&D came to me and he said, David, there are other inventions in you. And I said, Bob, I don't think so. I just got lucky. And I was driving home one day and this thing filtered into my brain. Mm-hmm. But he said, no, there's other products in you, but let me give you some advice. It's the problem, not the product. I said, oh, okay. And then about 5 years later, I was in the operating room. And we have these airways we put in patients, and we don't want them to bite down on them. And so we often put a little bite block in the molars. And I did what every anesthesiologist in America would do at that time, took a tongue blade and some gauze, and I was wrapping tape around it so that I could put it between the molars so that the patient wouldn't bite down on the tube. And as I did that for the 10,000th time, I thought, that's a problem. And from that, invented this little bite block. And so I give Bob Viereg total credit for that. Uh-huh. He told me it's the problem, not the product.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the inventing a few things was just this little sort of side thing that I did mm-hmm. in my career. Just one of the things that made it a richer career.
Uh-huh. So let's talk about that. I'm not sure if I should talk about it as intuition or faith, or you know when you got that download, if you will, you know, what is your faith, what is your intuition, how does that play into how you treat patients?
As for the invention, yes, it was downloaded. I'm not sure where it came from, but it was out there somewhere, mm-hmm. just filtered into my brain. You know, I grew up in a family that my father said, we're agnostic. And then he also said, but understand this, there is no God. So it was sort of the far end of being agnostic. And I found myself in my 30s, I had the car, I had the house, I had the kids, I had the wife, I had the vacations, all the things you could ever want. And yet patients were dying and some were dying young. And it was really troubling to me. And I thought, you know, what's the point of all this? And I just went through a personal journey and in my early 40s became a Christian. And faith at one point, and then faith became important in my life. And at first it was sort of asking God as my cosmic concierge to give me this for this patient, and let's have this outcome for that patient. Mm-hmm. And I had a patient that I had met him in the holding area, and his pastor was with him. And because of that, and they talked about how the church had prayed for him. I said, I've already prayed for you today, because I would pray for my patients before I started my day. And that patient died, and it was just really shook me. It shook my faith. And I transitioned then from praying for outcomes to just praying to do the very best that I could, and that my hands would work properly, my mind would work properly, pray that the surgeon would do their job properly, and then that I would just accept whatever outcome it would be. Mm-hmm. So that's how faith ended up in my life and in my career.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that. And so there was a place in the book where you had a realization when your daughter had to go into the hospital. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. We all have empathy for people, and physicians have to really do their very best to understand how desperate patients are and how difficult it is to be a patient with a chronic illness or fighting for your life or whatever the challenge is. And physicians, we work hard to do that, I think it helps us to put our full energies into making a patient better. I had a patient with big back surgery that had almost died in the operating room. It almost bled to death with a condition called DIC, or disseminated intravascular coagulopathy. As a matter of fact, 2 weeks after the case, the surgeon sent me a book as a present. And I said, Frank, what's this about? And he said, remember that DIC we had? My first two died on the table. Oh. So it's a real life-threatening bleed. And my daughter, my 18-year-old daughter, had the same operation 2 years later. Now, it's a very, very rare, unusual complication. But late into the surgery, she developed the DIC. And for the first time, I was in the position of a parent, of somebody who had a loved one in the operating room who could very well die, and she almost died. And all of the training that I'd had, and all of the insight that I had in medicine, and all of the knowledge that I had, didn't mean anything. I was just as helpless as every other parent is. And it was just an experience that I think deepened my understanding of what families go through. And it's one of those things that I think until you live it, you don't really understand it.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So I think it made me a better doctor. I think it's a lot of those kinds of experiences that we have that do make us either a better doctor or a better, lawyer, a better mother, whatever experience it is. You have to experience them.
That's true. And I find that sometimes when I'm in that situation where I've experienced it, I have to be careful to go not too much in the other direction. In other words, if you start empathizing too much, it's hard to do your job because you're feeling so overwhelmed for that patient.
Yeah, I think in one of the chapters, I talked about how is it that physicians sort of can keep it together when everything is falling apart around them. And, it may sound callous, but you just depersonalize what's going on. If you've got a patient that you're fighting for their life in the operating room, you forget about the fact that you met the wife 2 hours ago and there were two children in the room. You just say, this is a clinical case. This is a patient. I know how to do it, and I'm going to do my job. And you try to take the human element totally out of it, so that you can just focus on the job at hand. And that's hard enough with a total stranger that you're taking care of. Imagine trying to do that with a family member. And that's why physicians should never, ever take care of their own family unless it's something trivial. You just fall to pieces.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I'm wondering, you've been in the profession for so long. There's so much technology coming out. I know when I came out, I've been out of school 30 years. So there's so much changes. So I can see a patient walk in and I can kind of see how they walk. I see their facial expression. There's so many things you're observing as a clinician just when you just see that patient. And a lot of the younger people coming out, if they don't have the technology, if they don't have this or that, they don't have those skills. So where do you see medicine going, especially even with like digital or virtual things?
Yeah, not in a good place. I'll tell you a little anecdote. I've got this little thing in the inside of my mouth, and I had to go see an ENT guy today. And he is actually a world-renowned ENT surgeon. He's an older guy like me, and he was examining me, and he looked at it, and he put his finger in my mouth, and he felt it, and he didn't have a glove on. And he said, I just washed my hand. And he felt it. And then he took his hand out and he washed his hands. I said, James, I'm so glad you did that. You know, I mean, it just said, I'm an old doctor. We didn't worry too much about gloves way back when. And I can feel it better with my skin rather than that latex. And so that's on one end of the spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum is the technology that you just said. We live in a day now where most doctors do not examine the patient. And one of my criteria to see a physician, my wife has had a lot of orthopedic work, and the group that I take her to, I take it because they're good technicians, good surgeons, but they always examine her. And I think that the technology is moving us farther and farther and farther away from the patient. The medical record has been terribly intrusive with all of the, you know, I'll stand there and fill out an iPad rather than examine you. And then rather than examine you, I'll look at the scan. So as much as technology gives us advances, I think it separates us as humans, as doctor and patient.
So, when you're working with patients and you have this chapter on expectations, is that expectations that the patient has or expectations that you have?
Well, it turned out to be expectations that I have because it was such a profound experience that I had. We were in Romania on an Operation Smile trip. And just as an aside, there's nothing more rewarding, I think, at least in my career, than going on a mission trip. You got back so much more than you gave. But we were on an Operation Smile trip, and it was unusual. Normally we operated on cleft lips and palates, but we had some orthopedic surgeons. And we operated on a little girl about 10 or 11 years old who had club feet and the worst club feet you could ever imagine. She hadn't walked in years. Her feet, you know, her leg and in her foot, rather than like this, was just straight down. And she also had syndactyly, and that is webbing of the fingers. So her hands were like flippers, and a few other things going on as well. And the surgeon elected to do the club feet, and that's she'd live with the rest of the stuff. And the operation was called a 4-foot osteotomy, where you saw a wedge of bone out so you can bend the foot up, put some screws in, and now she's going to be able to walk, stand, not walk very well, sort of a staggered gait. She's still going to have her syndactyly. And as she was waking up from her anesthetic, she was crying. And I thought, oh gosh, I don't have near enough narcotic on board. I thought I had it just right. And I leaned down, I said, Lydia, are you hurting? Are you in pain? And she shook her head. And she's really sobbing. And I said, Lydia, why are you crying? And she wouldn't answer. And the tears are flowing. I said, and I tried again, Lydia, why are you crying? And she looked up and she said, I'm normal. I'm normal. And for her, having those feet bent up at 90 degrees, she can have her flipper hands. That's as close to normal as she's ever going to get. But it was enough for her. And that really helped change my whole expectations about what I should have. What do I need? So it was those kind of experiences that when you ask me, what did I learn in my medical career? Things like that. Things that, you know, you experience them. And then from that day on, you're a different person.
Yeah. I mean, how can you not be?
Yeah. It was just such a beautiful experience. You know, I mean, it was heartbreaking, but it was wondrous at the same time.
Yeah, that's exactly the word. Yeah. Wondrous, wondrous. So, and you said you've been on, how many trips have you been on with?
We went on 7 or 8 of them, I guess. You know, I went with one of my partners, and, you know, I'd always said, I'm going to go on a mission trip. I've got to go on a mission trip. But I was lazy. And I was always coming up with an excuse. Oh, the kids are too young. Oh, I've been working too hard. I can't take that week off to do that. I need to rest up. But I went down to the Caribbean finally on a week. And my partner, Mike, went with me. And it really, it just changed us. It energized us. And we were back in Nashville for about 6 months. And he passed me in the hallway one day and he said, "Hey, David, we're going to Romania." And I thought, I went home and I told my wife, I said, "Joyce, I'm going to Romania." She said, "What are you going to do there?" I said, "I don't know. But my days, we're going to Romania." So we had that week and it was just this, I mean, it was really hard. It took us 26 hours to get there. We were totally trashed and tired the whole time. So we said, all right, we're going to stay in the Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. So all the other trips were to Central and South America, mm-hmm. but and they were for cleft lips and palates. But we were in the Nashville airport, and I'll always remember heading down to Peru or something. And Mike turned to me and he said, "You know, David, it's an hour and a half of our life. It's the rest of their life." Mm-hmm. And I remember, I think in Nicaragua one day on a Wednesday morning, you know, you're tired, you know, the days are really long and it's 6:30 in the morning and the team leader is talking to us and he says, "Hey, I want to read a letter that I got." And it was, "My son is 16 years old. He's never been to school. He's never had friends. He's in the house all day, every day, because he'll be shunned." And, oops, I'm so sorry about that. It's a phone. He said, "You have given him his life." I can. Okay, I had to get rid of that. I'm so sorry. "You have given him his life." And you realize it really was his life, his whole life ahead of him. Now he can have a life. Mm-hmm. So that's why going on those missions were just such a blessing.
Yeah. And you mentioned something about being tired. So I know a lot of physicians throughout their careers, y'all are known for working long hours, not sleeping. How do you handle that and keep your energy going?
I don't know. Yes, you know, they've changed it a lot now in training that hours are limited. But depending upon your specialty, you know, if I was in a tertiary hospital where we did a lot of cardiac cases and a lot of other, you know, big bad cases, and a lot of those came at midnight, and you know, you'd work all day, and it's 11 o'clock and you finally went to bed, and 11:30 the phone rings, you can't say, you know, I'm really tired. I had a long day. You know, you just do it. I would throw 2 cups of coffee in a thermos and drink it on the way to the hospital. And, you know, you just dig down and do it. It was certainly one of the parts of the job I didn't care for.
Mm-hmm. And then as you were working, how did you fit in your family time? How did you make that work?
Yeah, you know, I think I'm like a lot of docs, and I look back and say, oh gosh, you worked too hard. You did too much in your job. I was in hospitals that were growing fast because Nashville was growing fast. And we were always looking for people, always short. So I didn't have a lot of time with my family, but I had a wife who was wonderful that did, you know, 98% of what needed to be done in the family. So that when I came home, I had my children and I had them until bedtime, and they had me 100%. Now, it wasn't for 4 hours, maybe it was for 40 minutes. But it was evidently enough for them. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, they're typical kids now, they're adults, but they say, Dad, you were the greatest dad ever. And you go, I don't know how I pulled that off. I think it was mainly my wife doing most of the work of the household. Right. Yeah, very fortunate to have her.
Leads to my second question. Is it 45 years you've been married?
Yep.
All right. You know what the question is. What's the secret? Because there's so many people divorcing these days.
Yeah, you know, we see some friends that it's 30 years, 35 years, and they split up, and I mean, and I'm thinking, guy, what are you thinking? You know, what do you think you're going to find out there? You know, you've got this devoted woman, the mother of your children. I think first of all, be careful who you marry. And I talk about meeting my wife in the book, that, you know, I met her at a party and I was like immediately dazzled. So, you know, I think you've got to be dazzled by your spouse. Mm-hmm. And you've just got to be committed. You know, you say, hey, we're in this for the long haul. And, you know, if times get tough, I'm not going to give up on you. Don't you give up on me. Mm-hmm. So, I'm just blessed in that regard that things have worked out real well.
Yeah, but commitment is important. So just to change gears a little bit, if you were talking to a young person, let's say they're in high school, starting college, and they said, you know, I want to take that same trip you took. I want to go into medicine. What would you tell them? What advice would you give them?
I would tell them, first of all, to try to shadow some doctors to get a lot better look at what it is, what it's like. Because it's so hard to know a profession when you're that far away from it. You know, you've had interaction with your own doctor, but that's about it. Otherwise, it's Grey's Anatomy. Mm-hmm. I had a friend that called me a few weeks ago and said, David, please just watch the first episode. I'm enjoying it so much. I want to know how accurate this is. Mm-hmm. And so I watched the first episode and I called him and I said, Gary, there was nothing accurate in the whole show. I kept looking for something that would be accurate. Nothing. So I would say shadow a doc. And most, you know, a lot of high schools, like my girls went to an all-girls school and they had something called winterm. And that was a 2-week period of independent work. And I set up for one of them to spend a day with a different doctor each day. You know, a cardiologist this day, a cardiac surgeon that day. And it really gave her a real perspective on medicine. And she's now a child psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. So try to do that. And I would say if you're sort of thinking you might want to be a doctor, that's not enough. It's a hard job. It's a long road. So you better really have this burning desire to do it. And if you have that desire, then it's absolutely worth it. You know, put in the work, because you'll, you know, there's just nothing more rewarding than taking care of a patient. You know, I mentioned in the book that as an anesthesiologist, within 10 or 15 minutes, I have total strangers trusting me with their life. Mm-hmm. And I mean, how cool is that? You know, I mean, to, you know, I guess we, you know, maybe that's how the airline pilots feel, mm-hmm. but it's pretty awesome to be given that amount of trust. Mm-hmm. Must really be an important job.
You know? It is, so, and a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, and if you realize that, and if you really can connect with people, I'd also say you got to be a people person, because you've got to be devoted to them. You can't, you know, you know, there's so many physicians that I know that are now my age and they're retiring. And it was just such a great group of people, because they weren't just doctors. They were devoted. Mm-hmm. I think you got to have that. So if they said, I really want to be a doctor, I would say, all right, spend some time with one. And if you do really want to do it, do it. If it's sort of a, absolutely not.
I have to agree. I had a patient that asked me that today. He said, how long does it take to be an optometrist? I said, 8 years. He said, well, I'm thinking for, you know, what my daughters can do. And I said, well, they have to really want to do it. I said, because it's hard.
They really want to do it. And if they wanted to take a little shorter course, I would say, think about going into nursing. Mm-hmm. I think nursing is a really hard profession. Mm-hmm. And if you ask me, which profession do I admire the most? Nurses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm so happy they got recognized during COVID, you know, because they were the unsung heroes.
They really were the unsung heroes. And sure. I had talked to some older nurses and they said, you know, we're still working. And some of the younger nurses who had just started, they all quit as soon as COVID left. And then there's our 50, 60, sometimes 70-year-old nurses still on working.
Yeah. And they were like those doctors, devoted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a beautiful thing. So let's talk about your book now. So we've talked a little bit about it as we've been having our conversation, but why did you decide to write the book, and where can people find it? And go ahead and tell us the title and everything one more time.
Okay. I want to show the cover. Can mm-hmm. I show that?
Yes, please. So,
I'm so pleased with the cover. And it really shows an older doctor's hand over a younger patient. Mm-hmm. And that's my hand over my daughter's hand. It's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. To me, that says a lot about the book, that it is a lot about patients and taking care of patients. I finished this wonderful career, and these incredible things had happened that I realized had never been written about. And I thought, well, I'll write about them. And then as I did, it turned out that I was writing these stories of patients and the lessons that they taught me. And it went from being a sort of a biography to being more, you know, I want to say spiritual in a way, in that I just wanted something much more important with a bigger foundation than, look at these exciting things that happened in the OR. I wanted something to say, but how does that translate into my life? How can that make me a better person and live a richer life? Mm-hmm. So that was really the point of doing the book when it finished up. It's available on, the title, Saving Grace. And what patients teach their doctors about life, death, and the balance in between. I've got a website, savinggracebook.com. Take Saving Grace and put book and .com and you got the website. People can email me off of that. And it's got an audio excerpt and a written excerpt and some praise and the usual things that a website has. I've got a couple, I'm on TikTok and Instagram as Dr. David Alfrey. And to my great surprise, I've only been doing this about 6 months and I've got all these followers. I thought, really? But that's been kind of fun, just sort of just general medical things. And this is available at you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the sellers. If it's an independent bookstore, they can order it through Ingram.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now a personal question. What gives you the most happiness and fulfillment in your life at this point?
You know, my wife has some health problems. She's a chronic pain patient. And I think what gives me the most happiness and fulfillment is when I can make a difference in her day or her life and she has a better day.
Oh, that's beautiful. It just shows your love and commitment again to her and your family.
Yeah. What is life without that, though?
That's right. It's nothing. It's nothing.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast today and for sharing all your stories and your life. And thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a lot of fun talking to you.
Yeah. So I have one last question that I ask everyone.
Okay.
What is your best advice for living an incredible, amazing life?
I think my best advice is to realize that life is not about things. Life is about people. If you attempt to get an amazing, incredible life out of the things that you have, you know, that hot car or the things that you do, I climbed that mountain, I think it'll ultimately be unsatisfying. But if you center your happiness on people and on relationships, much richer, much more rewarding. I mentioned in the epilogue that just because of the work that I did, I was privileged to go into a lot of hospital rooms where the patients were dying. And it was always a quiet place, almost a sacred place, just family members there. And there were no gold records on the wall. There was no talk of contract signed, money made, honors achieved. It was just who they loved and who loved them. And at the end of the day, that's what it boils down to. So to have that fulfilling life, focus on your relationships.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you again soon, Dr. Alfrey.
Okay. Thanks for having me.